Thanks to Imagix for sponsoring today's episode of Does Not Compute. Imagix, spelled I-M-G-I-X, is real-time image processing as a service. By using one master image, you get full control over its display output just by changing some URL parameters. This is cropping, rotation, automatic format detection, blurs, blend modes, masking, face detection, and some other really awesome tools. Imagix helps save a ton of development time, gives designers way more creative flexibility, and it's all running on a super fast CDN. Their average response time is just 70 milliseconds. Imagix is designed to scale. They're powering a lot of big names like Kickstarter, Foursquare, and The Guardian. They've got some great case studies on their site as well, including one from Eventbrite, which is using Imagix to process images for 2 million of their events per week. It's super easy to integrate into your existing site or application. They've got libraries available for pretty much every popular language. We've got a link to the Imagix site in show notes, so make sure to check that out. You also get a $10 account credit when you sign up, so it's totally risk-free to give it a go.
So what have you been working on this week, Paul?
I am getting super, super close to finishing up the database migration for Knight Foundation. So I don't know how much you know about that project. They are currently running on a Django site.
Sure.
And we're taking that and converting it over to a Rails site. And that requires moving all that data into a format that Rails can understand and that's going to work well with the relationships that we have going on. Because it's a redesign as well as a backend migration.
Sure.
So I've been working on getting the data all moved over for, I think, around three-ish months now. A lot of that time has been spent going through the existing data and figuring out how it all ties together, because I don't actually have access to the existing code either. I only have the database.
You just have a raw dump of the database.
Yep. All I got was a SQL file. So I don't have access to the code, and even if I did, I'm not a Django expert, so it would be kind of difficult for me to figure out what was going on anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So I've spent a lot of time looking through that data. I imported it into a local Postgres instance, and I just kind of have that running. And then I've been building out a Rails schema based on the existing one and writing a bunch of rake tasks to port everything over.
How has that process been? How much time are you spending writing documentation versus actually writing these migrations?
I think the majority of my time has been documentation writing, especially because there's going to be other people working on the project. But one thing that's been especially important for me is I can't keep all of this in my own head even.
Right. Yeah.
There's so many tables in the current database and they all have to be migrated in a slightly different way, or some of them aren't being migrated. So a lot of it is just going through and making sure every last thing is documented. That's been a major part of this migration for sure.
Right. And I bet that's pretty difficult. You only having a database dump, you don't have access to any code, you don't have access to any comments or anything like that. You just have the raw data.
A lot of it is going through and saying, okay, how do I think this works? And if I actually join these two tables based on this foreign key, does that make sense? Because unfortunately, a lot of the table names right now aren't consistent.
Sure.
So it'll be stuff like one thing might be called article, but then in a different place, it'll reference a blog post ID or that sort of thing. So there's dozens of inconsistencies like that that kind of have to be sorted out by hand.
That just sounds like it could get really frustrating really quickly not only no access to source code or anything like that, but also there being inconsistencies in the data. I guess, you can go about managing that a little bit and writing documentation and making notes for yourself. But are you doing anything like, are you making small sets of data and testing the importers or anything like that?
So kind of the way that I'm going about this is that I look through everything and I have it all written out in front of me. And then I write up a rake task. All the rake tasks have their interdependencies. So before importing articles, that task makes sure that authors are imported correctly and all that sort of thing.
Sure.
And I'm also storing the legacy primary key in the new data as well, just so I can reference and see if something has already been imported. So both of those things kind of combine to make it really easy to rerun things as needed.
Right, yeah.
So I can say, for example, if I need to change the authors, I can just change that importer and then go back and run it again and run all the things that depend on it as necessary. And it doesn't break anything because it can be automatically aware of what has already been migrated and that sort of thing.
That's a pretty good idea. Do you just have another database running that you have the legacy data on that you connect to pull things out of?
Yep. So right now in my database YAML, I actually have, it's just called KF legacy development, and it just specifies a different database to talk to. And, and then in each rake task, I actually just set up a active record class inside of the task itself. So for example, right now I'm looking at the one for press releases, and this is called, it's just class legacy press release inherits active record base. And then I just specify the table name. So in this case, press releases were called, the table for those in the old database was publications article funding option, which doesn't really make any sense,
right?
But it's fine because now it's specified in something that does make sense in the new naming scheme, and it's fine. And then you can tell an active record class to connect to a different database just with the established connection method. So I can just specify connect to this database with the other data instead, and then it's just a standard model, basically.
That's really cool. And that also might act as maybe a second piece of the documentation as well, because you're specifying table names and things like that and right in the task.
Yeah, it's extremely self-documenting, because each of the importers is named after its name in the new system.
Sure.
But you can find what it was called in the previous system really easily through that. So these class definitions are only, you know, 4 to 8 lines long. They're extremely short, but they allow me to pull that data in a really Rails-y way. So then I can actually do legacy press release.find each and actually deal with those as active record objects, which is very intuitive.
Right, and you just get that by inheriting from active record base.
Yep.
So then you're just going basically table by table and moving each piece over?
Yeah, pretty much. I go through each table, look at each column, figure out which ones actually need to be migrated and which ones don't, find all the relations, and then write up the task, and then additional tasks for join models.
That seems like a pretty good way to go about it. I mean, even considering, you know, inconsistencies in naming and things like that, it sounds like you have this nailed down pretty well.
It's keeping things really clean. And fortunately, this isn't my first time having to do a big migration. I've had to do this before when we worked on Sketchbook project, for example.
Right.
Not quite to this degree, but it's good to have this be my second rodeo.
So say that I had a project coming down the pipeline and I had to essentially do the same thing, you know, migrate tons of data from a legacy app to a new app. Were there any gotchas that you would want to make me aware of?
I think the biggest thing that I wasn't thinking about enough at the beginning was how much documentation you need to write, because you really want everything documented.
Yeah.
The old columns versus the new columns and how they map and all that sort of stuff is just great. So we're using GitLab issues for this internally, but that kind of works with any good source control that has issues built in.
Right. And then obviously down the line, like I think we mentioned in an earlier episode, how you kind of, as a contractor, you kind of have to think in terms of when you write your code, other people are going to see this later on. And when you're writing this documentation, that is incredibly helpful, you know, to the next person that's going to be working on this.
Definitely. Most of the time that I've spent over the last 3 months on this has been dealing in documentation. The migrations themselves are not that difficult to write. It's figuring out how and why things need to be migrated.
Right.
I think this is kind of one of those surprisingly useful skills, especially if you're doing contract work, because a lot of times you'll be updating a legacy application, or you'll be dealing with something where you're going to have to make old data talk to new data in some form. And so this is kind of one of those things that you never really hear that much about, but when you have to do it, it's so good to have an understanding about it.
Yeah, this is all advice that I can take to heart right away, because this migration stuff and coming from a front-end development background into the back-end world, data migrations have been really intimidating to me. And they're one of the things that I am least sure of when I'm working on that sort of thing. So having these small things to keep in mind is great. So earlier you linked me to this article by the Heroku engineering team called Upgrading to Active Record 4. And, you know, if you were to ask me how I would go about upgrading Heroku, you know, a pretty big company with a pretty big app that does lots of complicated things, how would I go about upgrading them to Active Record 4? I really wouldn't know where to start, but after reading the article, it seems like they were doing a lot of the same things you were doing. They're just breaking this large problem, this really complicated problem, into small pieces and running these small pieces one at a time and just testing those pieces until they all kind of worked together. And then they were able to make the big upgrade.
I think that's kind of a really key part of it is tests. If you have a great test suite, that's massive for making upgrades easier. Right. Because you can just go in and change any piece of your code base and you'll know right away exactly what parts need to be fixed.
Right. I'm pretty sure they actually specifically talked about how their acceptance testing really helped them out. So they would upgrade a portion and then each developer on the Heroku team has basically a private test version of Heroku that they can run. And so they would just run the acceptance test and see if anything was broken, and they would go through and fix errors one by one.
I personally think that trying to do upgrades is one of the best arguments for having a good test suite. It's just so, it makes it so much less scary and so much less of a dangerous idea to upgrade things. Because then you know, if your tests are good and you have great coverage, then you know everything that's affected by changing any component, which is such a massive piece of upgrading software. Obviously, in the case of the Knight Foundation project, I don't have access to the original code, so even if there are tests, I couldn't run them. But in the case of something like Heroku or any Rails app, if you're staying on the same platform, but you want to upgrade pieces of your platform, writing tests beforehand is one of the best things you can do.
Well, not only that, but in my experience, writing tests for your software actually help you understand the software better. And I've read arguments where people say that your tests are essentially documentation for your application. And, you know, I think that is true to an extent. I think for me personally, in thinking of features and thinking about especially upgrading features, if I have tests that I can write, it helps me kind of internalize that information in my mind.
So I found this really cool article on metaprogramming. It's on Toptal. And I thought this was such a cool overview of how metaprogramming can help you be a better programmer and also kind of demystifying it a little bit. Because I think a lot of people, when you start talking about stuff like metaprogramming or reflection, any of that terminology, it can scare people away.
Yeah, it can totally sound really intimidating really quickly.
But the fact of the matter is this stuff is not all that difficult. Once you understand, it's kind of like regular expressions, right? It looks really scary and it sounds really scary. But then once you've done it a little bit, at least the basics of it are pretty darn easy to understand.
I think maybe what makes some of that intimidating to me is just terminology used. It sounds really academic.
Yep. Very technical sounding for sure. I mean, just even the word metaprogramming sounds like something you need to go to college for.
Sounds fancy.
It does. It is fancy, though. That's the cool thing. It's fancy without being difficult. And it's kind of one of those things that once you understand it and start to implement some of these concepts in your code, you can do stuff a lot easier and cleaner. And future you will thank you.
Okay, so say that I had no idea what metaprogramming is all. In a nutshell, how would you explain that to me?
So metaprogramming is just writing code that allows code to think about and reason about itself. So at the most simple level, you could do something like, let's say we have a user class, mm-hmm. and you have an instance of user. So you do my user equals user.new.
Sure.
Pretty straightforward. Then if you type my user.class, that's a way of reflecting. So the object is looking back at itself and saying, hey, what is my class?
Right. That makes sense.
So for Ruby in particular, that example would be something you would probably try to avoid because Ruby is more about duck typing instead of actually checking something's class. You would see if it responds to a method or that sort of thing.
That's interesting. Recently, I've been working on an app where there's a polymorphic association, and to get one of those associations to update when another association is updated, I have to... Well, my solution is to check the class that was updated, and I'm actually using thing.class.
That's definitely one way to handle it. It's just kind of one of those things where it's a Rubyism to not do that and to like see if it responds to a method and make decisions based on that instead of the actual class.
Sure.
there are pros and cons to that method, and it's probably a little bit beyond what we want to talk about here, but that's the basics of it. You can check something's class, or you can check if it will accept, if it responds to a method, or you can see what it inherits from. So you could find out if a class inherits from active record, or if it's just a normal object.
Right. Okay.
And that sort of thing. So that allows you to make decisions based on all sorts of stuff.
Now, see, after you explain it, it doesn't sound so difficult. And it turns out that I've actually done some of this stuff before.
This is one of those things where people see metaprogramming and people see reflection, and they really think, oh man, that's beyond me. I can't deal with that yet. Maybe next year.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, you've probably already done some metaprogramming kind of stuff.
Right. So can you give me an example of where metaprogramming has been directly useful for you?
So I think probably one of the simplest examples I can think of is on user models in Rails. So if you need to generate a token for, you know, authentication or password resets or whatever, I actually tend to use a very similar method to what Ryan Bates recommends in his authentication setup, which is just a private generate token method. And then in that, basically you generate a random string and assign it. And then you check if self.class exists where that column has the random value generated. So basically you're making sure it's unique, because you don't want to throw an error. So you can't just have a uniqueness validation. You just want to make sure that each one generated doesn't already exist in the system. But then that generate token method can just be, you could put that in a module and import it into any class you want, or however you want to deal with that. It just means that then you haven't written out specifically user there. You're just doing self.class.
Right.
So it can automatically find what it needs to find out about itself.
Right. So then it's kind of decoupled from any of the models. You can use it anywhere you want to.
Exactly. It's a loosely coupled thing then, and it can just be pulled in and it'll just work.
Right. That's awesome. So it seems like to me then a lot of this stuff is useful for abstracting these functionality out and making it reusable and maybe making it more portable.
Yep, definitely. If you want to do something with, like I just said, if you want to pull it into a module or, you know, concern or something like that, this is a great way to help dry up your code, is using metaprogramming to make your code aware of its surroundings, I guess. I think that actually brings us to another really important topic. And we've kind of touched on this before, but I think this is such a critical thing, right? It's so important to know the details of the tools that you use every day, because you're using them every day. This is just like when people say, oh, you should go out and spend money on the best chair you can get, because you're going to sit in it every day, right? If you're going to be using these tools all the time, you should really learn the ins and outs. Not only will it make you more efficient, but it'll also help you to not feel like you always have to be looking for the latest and greatest thing.
Well, aside from that, the more that I get to know Ruby, it makes Rails seem less daunting. And Rails is something that I use a lot on a lot of different projects, right? So that's very important, and that's time well invested.
And that's not to say that you should dig super deep into every single thing that comes out by any means. But if you find yourself using a tool quite a lot, and you think it's something that you're going to keep using for the next several months or several years even, then that's something that you should probably spend some time, you know, read some blog posts, read some books, just Google around and spend some time following people on Twitter, maybe, who are really into that language or tool.
So that actually brings me to an interesting question, Paul. I've been hearing a lot lately about how people are talking about how jQuery is not needed anymore. You know, there's lots of sites giving examples of, if you want to replace or get rid of jQuery altogether, here's how you can do it with vanilla JS. And that's all fine and good, but I just feel like I don't need to give it up yet. It's not harming me in any way. And in fact, it's still providing me usefulness every day.
I think there's a big difference between using jQuery and being dependent on jQuery. If you feel like you wouldn't be able to make a site without jQuery, then that's probably not great. Like, you should definitely know how it works behind the scenes. And this kind of comes back, I guess, to knowing the tools that you choose, really understanding how they work on a deep level. But if you think jQuery is convenient and it helps you get stuff done, and you just don't feel like writing out an XML HTTP request and making sure that it works in every version of IE and every version of whatever, I mean, jQuery, you just write .ajax or .git or whatever, and it wraps that in a promise, and it's all fancy and done for you, and it, you know, it definitely does make things a lot easier for developers. Even people who really do understand JavaScript, it's just kind of a nice tool to have around, I think.
No, I totally agree. And I think the point that you made where there's a distinction between being dependent on a tool like jQuery versus using jQuery because it solves some problems for you.
Yeah, and that's not to say that I use every single part of jQuery every single time I use it, because that's just not the case. I don't think there's any site that uses every feature of jQuery except maybe the jQuery site itself. But the benefit, I think at least, is there in making your life easier. And that doesn't just have to be with jQuery. I think that can be underscore or Lodash or, you know, whatever your preference is there. Or something like Angular or React or Vue. Just because you don't use every last bit of it doesn't necessarily mean that you should throw the whole thing out.
Right. You know, it's interesting to me that I've even seen some articles that are making a case against jQuery because of some of the features that it has. I don't know. I just don't understand that thinking, because, like you said, just because a feature's there doesn't mean you need to use it.
Right. And I understand the desire to keep page weight down. I understand the desire to not include stuff that you don't necessarily need. Would it be cool if jQuery had a more modular build process so you could just make your own customized jQuery? Yeah, that would be pretty neat. But I also don't think that it should automatically disqualify something. Having a nice tool set that you really understand is just worth so much, in my opinion.
I totally agree. If it is the case that you're somebody that wants to have the security of using a DOM abstraction API, then there are other utilities out there for you to use. Like Shoestring by the Filament Group. Essentially, it's just a library that provides you a wrapper for Ajax and working with the DOM. And that's it.
That's pretty cool. And I think that's absolutely a valid option. If you don't want to use jQuery, don't feel like you have to. But if it's something that you're really comfortable with and you know really well, don't feel like you have to throw it out either. I think, kind of as with all things in development, it's a balance and finding what really works for you and your team's development flow. Thanks again to Imagix for sponsoring Does Not Compute. If you haven't had a look at Imagix yet, you're really missing out. This is the image processing solution I've been looking for years. Imagix takes all the hassle out of handling images. They've got an incredible collection of tools that let you programmatically recreate pretty much anything a designer can dream up. Check out the link in today's show notes, and make sure to check out their sandbox, which lets you play around with the full image manipulation feature set in browser. If you're enjoying the show but haven't rated us yet on iTunes, we'd love to have your support. Those ratings and reviews play a major part in spreading the word about Does Not Compute.